I don't think so. I think that that's you have an appreciation for the understanding of language, but not only that, you are aware of the context in which language evolves, but for good and for better or worse, really. And I think it's interesting you bring up grammar specifically, because are you familiar with the Trivium? Okay, sure. So that's, you know, the ancient intellectual pursuit of logic, grammar, and rhetoric, right? Like, as laid out by Plato and Aristotle and even Socrates, I think. But yes, I mean, you know, I only recently discovered that whole history, that whole tradition. And especially when it comes to grammar and rhetoric, I mean, the two really work hand in hand in the sense of, you know, well, communication is all we have. If we're all, if you believe the materialist point of view, in that we're all, you know, sentient individuals and disconnected consciously from each other, if you believe that, well, then communication through whatever medium is available is all we have. You know, we can't transcend our own consciousness. We can't link our consciousnesses together if you believe that. So to me, that makes the means of communication and the form in which our communications take, not necessarily the content, but the form that they take, is critical to getting anything across. Obviously, I mean, it's fucking basic signal theory. I mean, it's there's your signal.
Well, okay,
you know.
So,
go ahead.
So, is there just to say? So, let's make the distinction here. Like, okay, so I'm so with you. I'm open to the idea of a telepathy, like a literal telepathy, mm-hmm. but we actually already have a literal telepathy, sloppy as though it may be. If I send you an email, mm-hmm. I have this thought, I have transmitted it through the written word communication system,
yep.
to put that same thought into your brain.
Right.
That is a mechanical telepathy.
Yep, exactly.
Right, so we have that. And I'm with both of those sort of thoughts so far. But then there's the idea of, I was thinking, all right, so I've been struggling with this, Synquick news that I've, for weeks now, like, do I say a really like explicit point? You know, we had talked about the beauty of satire. Mm-hmm. Like, do I actually say, hey, no confusion here? Again, this is the importance of grammar. No confusion here. This is what I'm trying to fucking say. And then I keep falling back on this idea of going, well, even if I say that, it's going to be misunderstood. So maybe the thing to do is to, if you know you're going to be misunderstood, maybe you say something that at least gets someone thinking. So now it's not signal. It's not a when you say signal and noise, that the noise is actually an essential ingredient in the signal. I understand that.
Absolutely.
I'm going to send you. I'm not sending you a clear signal. I'm going to send you enough noise that you have to think about it.
Absolutely. Well, oh man, like that's, yeah. I mean, that's pretty much kind of summing up everything I want to kind of focus on in the podcast, and in this idea of noise being an inevitable component of any form of communication. Okay, it is unavoidable. It is inherent in the act of communicating. And when you consider the thing is that when you look at the history of kind of people studying communication, it's in any official academic capacity, it's always been very narrow in focus, and it's always been kind of almost entirely linguistic in its framework. And the problem is that communication has existed far longer than or human communication has existed far longer than human language. And because communication can manifest in so many different media, it doesn't have to be verbal, you know, and or written necessarily in order to be to convey information. And so this the fact that that's kind of overlooked in modern inquiry, I think, is well, just leaves a whole lot of territory open for exploration in terms of just saying, you know, not only will with regards with what we've been talking about letters and about language and alphabets, et cetera, but it applies to color, it applies to sound, it applies to music, it applies to film, to pictures, to painting. I mean, it's everything. And when you look, when you kind of just examine any of these media and how they've been used throughout history, and you kind of acknowledge that there's always some noise component involved in all of these things, okay? And the noise always the inevitability of that noise always forces the people who are creating this stuff to adapt to it somehow, and usually it's them trying to minimize the noise, but occasionally the noise becomes front and center and invents something entirely new. And a great example of this happens in music, okay, in general. And in my opinion, each generation will kind of define, you know, what is music and what is noise, or what's non-musical, I guess, sound. And it seems that the next generation always seems to come along and grab that very thing that their previous generation has deemed noise, and they make music out of it. And a great example of this is, you know, to my parents' generation, the sound of a record scratch means party's over, right? To my generation, to our generation, the sound of a record scratch means party's just getting started. I mean, it is a 100% reversal. Like, any as a classic sound effect, I work in audio, I mean, in sound design, you know, yeah. The record, like, that's, even today, is can still be used as, like, oh, everybody freezes, something bad happened, or whatever, you know, like on a TV show, as a storytelling element. But at the same time, the wicka 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 whack or whatever, you know, the DJ's just getting started. And so this happens in all sorts of music where the younger generation adopts, I mean, distorted guitar, for fuck's sake. Hello. I mean, electric guitar itself would not been was a response to a noise issue, literally, in the sense that the guitar player in these big bands could not be heard. That was the noise. Like, the guitar player was not getting, his signal was not getting through, literally. So Les Paul literally invented a way for the guitar to have six little microphones inside of it that will, you know, produce the sound. Because putting a microphone in front of an acoustic guitar will just create feedback. So, because of the way the sound hole resonates, it just immediately will create lots of feedback. So out of necessity, the electric guitar was invented because the guitar player wanted to be heard. So I'm saying, like, in the sense that I'm calling that noise, in a sense, right? Because that's an impedance on the signal, if you will. I'm just kind of going off now, but in general, you can approach, I mean, so even characters in our alphabet that we use today are the result of noise, a kind of noise, in the sense, like, the ampersand is actually what they call a ligature in typesetting, which is when, out of necessity, because they are literally needing a certain character to place in their rows when they're pressing their print of text, the word and in Latin, et, et, is what the ampersand is. That's what it was a ligature that was, you know, when they were still had printing presses, that they just created a single block that was the letter in cursive E and T combined, and that became the ampersand. So the noise in that situation was the fact that they couldn't say and when they wanted to as often as they wanted to. So that's the noise. So they, out of necessity, they invented the they built these little print blocks that had the word, you know, already, instead of individual letters, and we don't even most people don't even know that, you know? And so...
And...
Go ahead.
And let me just take it a step further. I had written something a few years ago when I first learned that. And to me, I mean, the idea that we have a symbol that obviously meant E.T. means something very different to us than it did to them. So now we have another variation on, it's like the realization that now our culture is proliferated with this symbol that essentially means E.T.
Mm-hmm. Oh, as an extraterrestrial?
Right. Like, yeah. You know?
Well, that's the thing. You could.
Steven Spielberg made, changed those two letters for, you know, we talk about children growing up after a certain point. Any child born after Spielberg's movie has a very.
Absolutely.
Instant,
like that just. E.T., yeah. That's totally true. It's funny, though, because. And then there's the word et. Is like a colloquial or like an old-fashioned, like now archaic word for eat in like, you know, we ate some good victuals or whatever, like archaic right. English. I don't know if it's spelled with one or two T's. I can't remember. But I even had to like, when I was in high school, I was in some musicals. You know, I did theater and I just still remember like, I had to sing some songs about some the victuals we ate or whatever. Like I don't even remember what the fuck it was, but yeah. I mean, there's that. It means "and" in Latin. You know, like I love the multi-layered, you know, aspect of any word. You know, and with the advent of the internet and sites like Wiktionary, which is probably my favorite website in the world these days because. How deeply you can get into the etymological history of a word. And you start looking at some of these really fundamental basic words of English, like, you know, for, F-O-R, or, you know, just these really basic words, and they have these massive entries on there. You go, you know, and you can trace these words through history, and when you look at what region or what ethnicity or nation or whatever was home to this language, and then you look at its history and how it changed or what letters or whatever were or how all these words differ, and then you consider things like the Norman invasion or whatever and all of these kind of socio-political aspects historically that influenced a lot of these changes, or it's like why every word pertaining to law and authority in English are French origin.
Right.
So you have a new oppressor and you have to adopt their language for oppression, basically. And check this out. With that in mind, check this out. So the origin of the word fuck, some people have claimed comes from, you know, the anagram for unlawful carnal knowledge or fornication.
Fornication under consent of the king.
Right.
Heard that.
There's that too, right? And I have a separate theory, and I could be completely wrong about it, but my theory is that the word fuck is actually not the original, or the word, or the phrase fuck you is actually the original phrase that fuck comes from. And... where I came up with that idea is that if you look at in Latin, the word for I that means I rule or I, you know, well, I.
The active I.
What's that?
The active I, like I do something.
Yes. Like, or I, no, I rule, or I am in charge, basically.
Okay.
Is F-A-C-I-O. And the way it's pronounced is fuck yo. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
So it's a word, it's a phrase that was heard very often by people being beaten to death and who didn't understand what it meant. So it's just, it's an interesting coincidence that something that sounds unbelievably similar to fuck you has that meaning when you consider it historically. And who was hearing that, especially not knowing what it meant, because they're foreign.
Right, you just know this is the thing you say when you're about to tell
This is what the fucking guy over
to,
me...
You listen to meme. You fucking listen to meme.
Exactly. Okay? And you can go to Wiktionary and type F-A-C-I-O, and there's a little pronunciation audio clip, and it's, fuck y'all. Fuck, I'll do it right now. And you can hear it. It's fucking weird, man. And I could, you know, it's probably just a coincidence, but this is how you can, like, spend hours on Wiktionary and speculating and with, in terms of considering just the historical context of how these words change. Because we use language that is victim of that very thing happening, you know? Not victim, I don't know how to, best way to put it, but. So I just find that endlessly fascinating. Let's see here. Here we go.
Fuck you.
Wow, yeah.
Fuck you. Fuck you.
It's crazy. I do, I make, I construct, I appoint, I build, I rule. Yeah. It's pretty, it means a lot of things. But anyway.
But it's definitely an authoritative.
Oh yeah. I mean, it's an affirmation of one's right.
Exactly, yeah.
That's powerful, you know. I anyway, but there's, I love examining and like the way in which all, you know, all languages relate to each other, and it's led me to like look into all sorts of, you know, study on like proto language. And there's this one guy who's narrowed things down to like 11 words that he believes were like the very beginnings of language. And it's amazing because it's like, oh, where are they? Let's see. But it's very telling if for anybody who's like into the kind of mother goddess way of thinking.
Okay.
I guess. Let me see here. Proto-language. List of proto-languages. Damn it, I had it written down. Oh wait, here it is. But because, so you mentioned before, like, even the dot, like a simple dot, right?
Right.
Yeah,
it's
whole
punctuation marks.
Yeah, okay, here we go. Okay. 11, which is another important, there are 11 words, let's see, aqua for water, boko for, there's two words for arm, and I think one is meant to be leg, but boko for arm and kanva for arm, and then, okay, so there's a word for water, arm, knee, nose or smell, another word for arm, a word for who, a word for what, a word for to, a word for vagina, a word for hair, and a word for finger, which also could be used to be the number one. And it's dick. The word for finger or one is dick.
Okay.
And puta is the word for vagina.
Which is still around today?
Mm-hmm. The word for what is ma. The word for two is pal or pal. Anyway, that's it. Those are the basic words. And it's very interesting that that's like all
right,
you...
What more do you really need to communicate besides my dick goes in your puta?
Well, here's the thing. You know, some people believe that the earliest language formed from a mother having to set her child down and keep it engaged, because at a, you know, up to a certain point in very early childhood development, they don't have object permanence, which is Like if some, if like, right. Yeah. Like cats have that problem. My cat has that problem.
Right.
So in order to keep a baby calm, a mother would, but still like be able to like gather food or do something important, would occasionally have to put down the baby and go and leave its sight. And so vocalizations evolved, as a way of keeping the baby calm by the mother.
I'm still here.
So that's one theory. And to me, and it coincides with this guy's assessment of what the like earliest proto words would have been, they're almost, you know, well, they almost, to me, almost say more about a mother-child relationship than just a female, an adult female, adult male relationship. And there's even some people that like speculate if somebody named Adam and Eve ever actually existed, that it was a mother and son, actually, not a couple.
Sure. Okay.
Which, well, you know, more speculation. Right. But just
the idea, just sort of the idea of what is that early relationship going to be? Because in reality, if you think about it logically, even if you had a quote unquote Adam and Eve, and I don't mean that in the literal biblical sense, but your sort of proto, you know, mm-hmm. the foundational archetypal
right.
parents of humanity. Well, daddy's out either working the field or hunting game. They're not really together that much.
Here's the other thing. There was definitely a period of time where daddy was completely not around because had no awareness that that baby was his.
Right.
How the hell would he know? How would the mother even know that that dude over there made that baby? How do they know that? They don't know that. I mean, they figured it out eventually. There's no indication in any other mammal, in any other primate even, that males have an awareness of fatherhood. That they have no awareness of these things are necessarily their offspring. That's all instinctive. In terms of them fucking, you know?
Right.
So what's interesting to me is why it seems more possible, I guess. Sorry, go ahead.
No, I'm just saying, yeah, of course. So the mother has the instinct to actually be with the young.
Well, it has to be, right?
Exactly, right.
I mean, the mother's the one that sits there and gets pregnant over 9 months and eventually probably realized, hey, wait a minute, sex, pregnancy. There's, I mean, the causality connection, right? Like, oh, I had sex and now I'm pregnant. Wait, I had sex with that guy and now I'm pregnant. And that means that that guy is the father. And then, you know, mothers probably realize this before fathers.
Right, and I'm sure looking at the child and if there's a resemblance, right? I mean, you know, you ever see...
Exactly, the resemblance. You know, exactly. So that's what I'm saying. It's like this idea of this ancient archetypal family doesn't strike me as logically very possible even. Because what's more likely to me is a grandmother, a mother, and a child.
Right.
When you really, because I don't know. I mean, because the male, I would think would. I mean, ultimately, yes, males figured out that they are fathering these kids, and maybe there is something in their interest of actually sticking around. You know, ultimately, the idea of fatherhood took form, but there was a long period of time before that idea ever existed. I think. And I bet language came along before that, too. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know either. I mean, I've definitely, like, I'm familiar with some of the ideas of, you know, sort of what the lifestyles were like. And like I said, what we can definitely say is there's not, just the idea that they're the ones that are forming these bonds. Like, it's a very romantic notion to say that it's a husband and wife, that it's the parents together.
Right.
But that seems...
Well, that reinforces everything we believe in today.
Right.
Or, I mean, traditional values, whatever the fuck you want to call them.
Exactly, yeah.
You know.
Well, I said, you know, it's like we should start a traditional values campaign, a true traditional values
campaign. There you go. Let's take it all the way back.
Walk down the street, fuck everyone I see.
Yeah.
Take whatever I want.
There you go. Yeah, where's your traditional values now?
Right. Really traditional values.
Totally. So, yeah, man. This is very much the kind of stuff I want to get into. So this is kind of getting into the center of my focus. Like I try to like approach things. I like to acknowledge both the kind of materialist and idealist on both sides, and really try to come up even sometimes with a third point of view by doing that, you know. But yeah, another thing in on the highest conceptual sense, I guess, of the idea of the show or whatever, and this idea of noise, and noise being something we would typically want to minimize or being something that we dismiss in general, and just that whole idea of dismissing things that we think we don't want, we think are worthless, or we think aren't true, or aren't good for us, or whatever, or aren't correct. All of these things, which applies to so many aspects of culture in general, but specifically, like, you know, I mean, I've been a person who I felt like is way too often dismissed, you know, even in my day-to-day life at work. It's like very frustrating. It's like, oh, what could the music guy know about anything? And it's like, all right, that's fine. And, you know, I've even developed a bit of a complex about it, but it's driven me to want to understand it on a larger scale, I guess. And just this tendency we have to people today who say things that are kind of crazy or irrational or illogical, why do we dismiss them when at the same time we so quickly idolize people who succeeded in overcoming all of our dismissing, and finally we came around to realizing they were right all along? And it's like, what are the dynamics there, you know? Because this is all of the type of stuff we're talking about, the nature of even a lot of the topics on Sync Book Radio in general are topics some would dismiss as...
Oh, not just some.
Many. Most.
Yeah.
You know? And I think that that's an area that doesn't really get a lot of attention, and just not necessarily just criticizing it or refuting it or engaging it, but understanding why it happens, I guess.
Well, I mean, you know...
Objectively.
I mean, it's the same... It's similar to spend any time away from, like, when you're stuck in the Facebook, you know, psychic vampirism that is Facebook.
Yes,
you know,
that's
you're just in it.
Well said.
But when you spend any time away from it, looking at it, it's like, what is this?
Right.
What are you people doing?
Right.
What the fuck are you doing? How is this enjoyable for you?
Right.
I find so. Like, we did. I was just talking to Doug the other day, and. So we did a few years ago, we had someone in Doug's family owns a cabin in the like mountains of Idaho.
Okay.
So a bunch of us went out there.
Nice.
And we stayed in this cabin for a few days, right? And now a handful of the group decide they want to go climb this mountain. And another handful decide we want to stay here and take psychedelics and do whatever, right?
Sure.
Or whatever. I mean, I actually was one of the ones that stayed behind. I didn't take psychedelics, but just to say, like, okay, we're going to stay here and keep hanging out. So some go off to do the trek up the mountain, and some stay to continue the, like, these conversations that would go on till, you know, 5 in the morning, right?
Sure.
The people come down from the mountain. No way to relate to our conversation.
Uh-huh.
Because at that point, their context so changed. It was such a, they were so physically, like, embodied in the thing that these intellectual conversations were like meaningless, right?
Yeah.
And I was saying to Doug, I said, I feel like, particularly for myself over the last few weeks, my day-to-day is basically work and sleep, right?
Mm-hmm.
So then I pop in on something, and it's I'm beginning to see how weird all this looks from the outside. Now, obviously, you know, not as much. I'm very familiar with all these things, and I obviously enjoy all these things, so it's not truly that vision. But I'm saying it's this, I was relating it to the mountain thing, is saying, like, I'm so physically, like, my existence right now is a very material existence.
Yeah.
So anything intellectual, esoteric, anything, it almost seems frivolous at this point. It's like, I don't have the luxury to be thinking about these things. I got to be up in 2 hours, you know, see you later. And I think this is another aspect of it. It's why, you know, quote unquote society, polite society, only really arises amongst, you know, it's founded in the gentry, the aristocrats, because they were the ones who had the fucking time to sit around and think about these things or explore these things, while everyone else is fucking working.
Right.
So, you know, we sort of have this split in society in that respect. And it's only now, as honestly, as hard as anyone could work here in America, we are still living high on the hog globally, so we have the time to spend on frivolous pursuits like enlightenment education, you know.
Well, that's the very reason why culture came about to begin with, is, you know, when we stopped being hunter-gatherers and domesticated animals and started farming, certain members of the tribe had a lot more time on their hands to start figuring other things out, like how to make how to fashion weapons out of iron and how to turn their thoughts into characters and all of these things. You know, it was just literally a matter of having more time. So,
and is that all anyone can ask? Yeah, exactly.
And that speaks exactly to what you're saying, I think, is that, you know, and even back to our other point about, you know, reaching a comfort level where you have the time to explore whatever it is that you like, but also, you know, you don't want to lose, and you're not necessarily even you're willing to sacrifice aspects of your freedom to hold on to other things, you know.
But, absolutely, right.
But yeah, it's true. I hear you.
I guess, so, you know, that's, this just makes, you know, this makes me think about a whole bunch of other things, but what I'm saying is that I'm getting I got a little bit of a glimpse into just how foreign and strange some of these things seem in these moments.
Yeah. Do you ever find yourself, when you're maybe like at work or just, you know, out and about, in trying to engage people in this type of thing, and it just kind of...
Oh, I gave up on that a long time ago.
My barometer for when I should or should not go into these areas is very bad. So, man, I've had some awkward experiences.
Oh, hell yeah. I've had so many awkward experiences that now I am like secret. I'm almost like secretive.
I understand.
Like, I feel like I go through my normal, like, quote unquote normal life as like an act. Like, it's like, I'm just a guy, you know. People try and talk to me about sports or TV, and I'm like, oh, that's cool.
Yeah, you just play along.
I nod and smile.
Right, right, right.
If nothing to say, I nod and smile. I go about my day.
Yeah.
And, you know, occasionally, every now and then, so like, I remember I was working, when I was in North Carolina, it was so funny. I was working at this place, And everyone, all my coworkers, started saying things like, oh man, the weirdest shit just happened to me, like the weirdest coincidence. You know, they kept saying these things about these weird coincidences. And I was so tempted to say something to engage them, right? Because they kept going, oh my God, you wouldn't believe the weirdest shit that happened to me today.
Yeah.
And I was just like, wow, that's really interesting. Wow, that's really interesting. And I kept, and then like finally, one guy, I said something to him, and he's like, huh. And just looked at me like, oh, you're fucking crazy. And
I'm
like,
oh, yeah.
You know, I was like, right, exactly.
Yeah.
You know?
No, I remember when I speaking of Facebook, I, around that time when I left Facebook, I got so worked up. I was like, and I definitely, speaking of the act that you have to go, you know, that you put on a bit when you grow out into the real world, so to speak, I was definitely struggling more than I had in a long time to maintain that. And this was, oddly enough, I discovered later that was the exact same time you guys were having your sync summit. And I'm at work, and like anytime Facebook would come up, I'm like, ah, Facebook, and I would just like go off, and people would look at me like I was fucking nuts. And it was like, but I was really worked up at the time too. And, yeah, you know, it's funny, like most people don't want to go there.
They don't want it. They don't want to at all. I mean, it's at every level.
There have been now for so long, so many ways for people to reinforce their worldview to such a point where it's impenetrable. No matter how logical or cogent or whatever your case may be, I mean, you can. The thing is that people now not only choose their news, they choose their facts. You know what I mean? It's like, and the idea of, well, I think, you know, the polarization just in the most kind of general sense, in the mainstream of media and politics and ideology and all that crap, the polarization has become so severe that it's completely clogged discourse. Because it just become, it's always the scapegoat of everything is, oh, it's, you know, they always just blame it on the fact that they disagree instead of, you know, the fact that they just don't want to. Sorry, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, particularly within the realm of sync stuff, it's fascinating because I believe, you know, we take, there's a certain amount of what I'm playing with is the idea that of course we're all looking at something and gonna see something different, right? Sure. So if we talk about, we can go to a museum together and we look at a painting and you see one thing and I see another, right. And then we try and apply that same idea to a wider spectrum. But then when you take it into the realm of like Fox News, MSNBC, you know, no, I believe that blah blah blah, it starts getting harder and harder and harder. Because now, for whatever reason, when we disagreed about the meaning of the painting, we weren't about to come to blows. We're not going to fucking shoot each other
right.
over the meaning of the painting. But for whatever reason, we've decided we're going
right.
to fight over the meaning of a flag or a...
Well, I think that, like, this idea, and this is something that's come up in some of the shows and some of the talks, is just this idea of perspective and how... you know, obviously every individual inhabits a unique perspective and coexists with all of these other people with their own individual perspectives, and yet we all are sharing an agreed upon kind of policy or culture, whatever you want to call it, of how we relate to each other and how we communicate with each other, all of the, you know, society, all of that crap, right? And the thing is I feel like whether it's a deliberate conspiratorial effort or not, I feel like the fact that a conscious mind has a unique perspective, the fact that that is true for anyone, is a source of great power to anyone willing, interested in, well, controlling another individual, because that's, I think, the single most disorienting aspect of living is the fact that you have your own unique perspective among this universe of,
Can you hold on just 1 second?
Yeah, sorry.
Hello.
I don't know why you say goodbye. Say hello.
I was expecting around this time to get a phone call from my job telling me if they needed me to work tonight.
Oh, I understand.
So,
well, yeah, we've been on it for a while here if you want to wrap things up. That's fine. I was about to go off the deep end anyway.
Let's say that because I felt that was going somewhere interesting.
It was, but we can resume at another time.
Yeah, I know you said you had till 3 p.m. West Coast. Which
oh
is,
yeah, that's not minutes. Exactly as firm as it was before. We were supposed to have my wife and I were supposed to have a call with our doctor, but that's been rescheduled actually.
Gotcha. Okay. So I might get a phone call here, but otherwise I'm fine.
All right. Well,
and, if you wanted to,
yeah,
go right ahead.
What was I saying? So we'll just this. You know, I was saying just like the fact that you know consciousness includes this unique point of view is, I think, you know, kind of fundamentally disorienting part of being alive. And I think that that makes any conscious mind very vulnerable, or potentially very vulnerable, in the for you know just being influenced. And obviously, we see that happen all the time, right? And I think that like what you were talking about with Fox News, MSNBC, all of these outlets, right? These channels, quite literally, they basically are providing a service to a mass population that acknowledges that, yes, it's very scary having to make up your own mind. It's a lot of work. It requires your attention. It's boring. It involves critical thinking. It involves constantly confronting what you think is true and what you think is not. And so we're going to do that for you. Because so you can get back to Xbox or whatever, you know, and that's a very attractive thing to most people today. And I think it, and you know, it's just, it's like worldview reinforcement or whatever you want to call it. And like I was saying earlier, you know, you get to choose your facts. But I think that, you know, when you consider that's what's being used against, I think, a lot of people is the fact that it's a terrifying notion for most people to kind of really shape their own point of view in a way that is virtuous in terms of your perception of reality, not virtuous in terms of your behavior, but just like really being fair to yourself about what you're experiencing. And I think
if I understand you correctly, is this like it's essentially the illusion. Like when we say we each have an individual perspective,
right?
If it was our individual perspective, that could be one thing. But it's the illusion of individual perspective. It's almost like there's a multiple choice of pre-approved answers. So you, Wally, you get to choose amongst these five perspectives. Do you think that this flag is A, racist, B, a freedom of speech issue?
Right. See, well, I think that's definitely.
And you're given these pre-prescribed things. Okay, so
I think that that's sorry, go ahead.
Maybe I'm misunderstanding. So to clarify, where do you see the distinction between a genuine like difference of perception versus, or maybe I should say, like, is there? You know, is there a truth in the sense of like, are there certain things that are not debatable or?
Okay. Yeah. Okay. So basically, I mean, my point about all of these different kind of, you know, things like Fox News and all that stuff is that most people, I think, prefer to lean on some external source for to basically reinforce what they already believe, so that they don't have to really think about it anymore. And you can say that about religion, you can say that about news, you can say that about a lot of different worldviews. And what I'm saying is that the only thing that is true, in my opinion, is what I like to kind of, what I like to call absolute relativity. In that, because of the fact that consciousness, as far as material science has been able to determine, consciousness includes this kind of caveat, is that it's only your point of view, as far as we can, as far as material science and all of this stuff says. Okay. And so because of that, it's inherent that all of our perceptions of what can be absolutely true will always be relative, the same way in which our perception of time will always be relative because of the, you know, Einstein's theory of special relativity or general relativity. And I think that those two things are inherently connected, those two facts or those two aspects of reality. Like, the fact that time is relative is very inherently linked to the fact that perception in general is relative. And so, let me think for a second here. I guess, and this relates ultimately to, I think, a lot of what drives people in this community to explore issues surrounding sync, because experiencing sync is also inherently linked to your point of view and your individual perspective. And it's the location and time and space of that particular consciousness. It's the very fact that it's in a certain point in space and time that causes that synchronicity. So it must be an important aspect of the synchronicity itself. And so if you try to continue thinking about that empirically, well, okay, so what are we talking about? We're just simply talking about a point in time and space and having some kind of significance tied to a consciousness that has a kind of, like in video game design, when you're a character, when you're making a game level or whatever, and you design and you're all the enemy characters that are moving around, they all have their vision cones, which is a space you literally define geometrically of where they can see and detect you, and then they're going to start punching you or whatever. So everybody kind of has our own vision cone. That's our point of view, right? And you can really start to talk about it geometrically even. So there's this point in time and space, and a vision cone coming out of that point in time and space at a particular angle and at a particular strength. And it happens to and that vision code happens to coincide with several other points in space and time that represent other consciousness, or could represent frozen consciousness, which is just some kind of record like writing or a picture or whatever. And all of those elements in physical space are colliding, right, and causing one particular consciousness in that mix to experience synchronicity. Why, right? Because all of the other consciousnesses that may be located in that space are not. They're there. They can perceive pretty much all of the same stuff around them that this individual is experiencing as more significant. So why aren't they experiencing it? And I think that it's within that territory of how, if you break all of these elements that we've piled all of this language onto things, like, oh, this is a book and it's fiction, and that means that it's a story that somebody made up and it's got characters in it and it uses language and letters and pictures and all this stuff. We have so much historical just sediment, or, you know, or like this pileup of rock formation, I forget the name of the word, of all of this culture that's piled up, and we don't necessarily see fundamentally that this is just bits of information that are floating around in time and space and tied to all of these other objects that are dynamically kind of colliding with it. And I think when you start looking at it in really reductive terms like that, you start getting interesting insights into why certain individuals in a particular scenario are going to experience something that they feel is synchronistic and others are not. And it all comes back to this idea of this particular unique perspective kind of just happened to align itself in a particular way and cause this to happen. And I think a really good analogy for this way of approaching it is, the type of sculpture, like mobiles, right? Like there's one guy who, an artist, Alexander Calder, I think is the most kind of badass. He was a sculptor and he invented the mobile, right? Which is, the sculpture that's in motion. You familiar with that?
Sorry, I was muted, yes.
Okay,
yes,
so and he writes, throughout his career, he wrote very little about his own philosophy. But just as a side note, Alexander Calder was good friends with a composer named Edgard Varèse, who was Frank Zappa's absolute 100% idol and was a big influence on him. But getting back to the point, Calder talked about when he unlocked this idea of motion in sculpture, what was significant to him is that as a viewer, you walk into the room and you see this this collection of objects, in motion. There is, from the moment that you as a viewer place your focus on that, you are experiencing a very unique alignment in time and space of all of these objects relative to you as a viewer and relative to the space in which you're in and relative to all of the other people in the room that are viewing it and having the exact same experience you are, but totally unique to them. They are seeing all of these objects align in a very specific way that only they see because they are physically in a position that allows them to, unlike you who are
standing. Both share the same space at the same time.
Right. So this is a beautiful analogy, I think, of this tendency for coming back to this tendency people have to dismiss what occurs, what some people may experience as synchronistic versus others. And this is a good way to kind of break it down in terms of why this happens and whether and totally remove from whether or not there is any truth or any validity to either side or either claim necessarily. But just kind of viewing it. And then if you kind of approach it almost from that perspective of saying, okay, here are all of the elements involved in this event, and let's look at them and let's consider all of the perspectives on all of the elements in this event. And you can even, not just on a person's perspective, but in any object that is relevant. And like, you can do the same thing with language. And that's coming back to what I was talking about like looking deep into the etymology of a word, that's literally, another great metaphor is that you're taking the word and throwing it up in the air and turning it on all three axes and all four axes and examining it and trying to say, okay, I am an Arab living in Damascus in 984. What does this collection of symbols mean to me? Versus I am a guy in Oakland, California in 2015. And this is all just data when you break it down. Those are all just pieces of data. Okay, white male at this longitude and latitude at this point in time interprets it X. Arab female and 1,000 years ago interprets it Y. And you could approach anything this way.
Sure, so we transpose that same line of thinking to you're a white Fox News viewer.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
You know?
Exactly.
Right. You're a black churchgoer. You're going to see these two, the same story, very differently.
Right.
This is an unrelated incident to me, and they're trying to impinge on my freedom to own a
right.
rebel flag.
Right.
You know, that's a symbol of my freedom. And someone else going, actually, I see the exact opposite, motherfucker. So it's this idea that, right. So you, it's funny because when I asked the question, it was I almost interrupted you very early on and said, for the record, it's a rhetorical question, but I was so happy with the fact that you were able to essentially speak to it very eloquently that I was like, all right, I'm sure he knows it's a rhetorical question, but that was still amazing.
So. What did you even ask me? I forget.
Well, it was basically like, you know, with if everyone has a unique perspective, is there such a thing as a truth, you know?
Oh. Well, yeah, no, I didn't take that rhetorically at all. I think that that's a fair question. I think that, because I think that there is, even, you know, in any kind of pursuit intellectually or philosophically, you can very easily kind of be misguided into thinking that.
It's a fair question. I just don't know if it has an answer.
I think it does. I think the only thing that is true is the fact that truth is relative. That's really the only truth that I can find. And I think that if you allow that to inform every kind of step of a process of kind of breaking something down and understanding it, it really, really forces you to rethink a lot of things. It certainly has forced me, you know, and I am nowhere near, you know, mastering anything. I don't claim to. I just... You know, it's remarkable where if you want to, you can literally start with anything. You can start with a word and just open it up and start examining it. And you will get back to the beginning of you'll get back to fucking prehistory in no time. And connecting more than you would have ever imagined. And especially when you start going back to like these proto words, like these fundamental things that people need to say to each other in order to survive, in order to exist, you know. And since that's the only means that anyone has to relate to each other, you know, I think it's really worth exploring. Obviously, people
yeah,
do.
I don't know
I'm not saying I've unlocked some hidden area of inquiry at all.
I mean... But you've, you know, wittingly or unwittingly stumbled upon a fairly tried and tested method for at least opening yourself up to other options in
yeah.
the sense that, like, that was a meditation that Aleister Crowley had recommended was take a look at any if you're sitting right here, so you're in Oakland, California, you say, okay, how did I get here?
Yeah.
So you say, okay, well, to get here, I was born in Texas, whatever. And you go, okay, I was born, well, in order for me to be born in Texas, my parents had to whatever. And then, okay, so that meant, and exactly, before you know it, you're, you know, well, okay, and then I had to, you know, the universe had to, you know, Earth had to be at this distance from the sun to be the right temperature to support life.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you're going back and back and back and back and back rather quickly. I don't know if you're familiar with Robert Anton Wilson's Maybe Logic. His thing is he calls it he promotes the idea of non-Aristotelian grammar. Basically, you can't say something is or isn't. You can only ever say it seems to me.
Right.
He's
right.
saying, you know, he's like, if there is no hard and fast truth, there's only relative perspectives.
Yeah.
Then the proper way, you know, and he's not saying like it's not like a dogmatic like you have to speak this way. He's saying you should try to think this way instead of going, motherfucker, it's like, you know, it's like this. Try and start using the language. It seems to me. You know, but like that, this whole thing of there is no there is no truth, there is no right or wrong. This gets, the reason I kept bringing it back to like say like a sensitive issue like the Confederate flag, which I don't know if that's something sensitive to you, but to bring it there is because sure. It's kind of like it's the introduction of the noise, because your gut instinct, like if I said to you like, hey, you have to go, it seems to me, well, if I come swinging an axe at your face, are you going to go, it seems to me that I'd prefer you didn't, I would, you know, I feel pretty sure that I wouldn't want that axe to hit me in the face. I'm not completely sure, but right. I'm pretty sure.
Right.
No, it's like, so these things, there are little moments that can, by introducing something that becomes personal or seemingly instinctual, it's easy to, it's the introduction of the noise into this music of, oh, of course there's no truth, you know, there's only relative truth. We start, you introduce something where you start going, like, is it, you know, is it all right for me to go, you know, go down to the corner store and, you know, kill everyone in there and steal all the groceries off the shelf? You say, well, you know, I can't really tell you it's wrong, but, you know, I wouldn't advise, you know.
Yes.
I guess I'm just saying it's this, I'm a total supporter of this line of thinking. I'm just saying I like playing the reason I say these are rhetorical questions is because it's always fun to throw these scenarios in there where you go,
right.
It would be really hard for me to not see that as a black and white issue, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And probably that's a good thing. I don't want to be open-minded to murder and mayhem.
Right.
I'm probably more in agreement with you than not. I'm just I'm always trying to play devil's advocate here in the sense of like, again, it's the introduction of the noise. It's saying, hey, okay, we have these ideas of what was called maybe logic, which I love, and the idea of saying it seems to me, I think is such a great mental exercise.
Mm-hmm.
But the question of like, is there ever a truth? I don't know if that can be answered.
Right.
And the only reason I say I'm open to the possibility of like, maybe there are some small lowercase t truths, you know?
Well, how could truth be verified, really?
Right.
Okay.
I get it.
But and that in itself is, could be regarded as a rhetorical question, but then how, okay, let's answer it rhetorically then. What if, through some means, we were all able, or what if, like, you were a witness in a murder trial, and somehow miraculously you were able to transmit your own memory of what you witnessed to the minds of the jury? That would be pretty, and the jury was able, it's not like they would be caught by surprise when this happens. It's like, yes, here we are, we're going to share our thoughts. And this is legally admissible in court, right? So what if there was it's almost kind of like in this idea that they explored in Minority Report, you know, this, the precognition of a crime, was admissible as evidence of true events, whether or not they occur or not.
Are you allowing for the malleability of memory?
I'm sorry?
Are you allowing for the malleability of memory, meaning that...
That too, right? So what if we consider photographic evidence as admissible of reality, you know, admissible in a court of law as a verifiable document of reality,
mm-hmm.
as it occurred, right? So what if, I guess what I'm getting at is when you consider some of the ideas like that Carl Jung talked about with the collective consciousness and the notion that perhaps there is an aspect of reality and consciousness that is shared among all people,
alive and dead. Is that a means to verify truth? If we're all able to, you know, through some channel in through which we can collectively perceive through this collective consciousness, is that a way of an entire species or whatever verifying truth? Maybe. Okay. what's compelling to me with that in mind is I feel like advertising and government and industry has demonstrated quite skillfully that that is very much a means to access an entire population, to deliver a particular version of reality. I mean, that's kind of what we all talk about, is that there has been this force pervasive in our culture that's been able to saturate media with messaging that delivers a very skewed and very tailored version of reality. So it's obviously that works, but it just doesn't necessarily work in the way in which we always predict. So,
yeah, I'm right there with you. Right, the idea that we can, as I'm saying, like the malleability of memory, this has been an issue with court cases. So even though I can't actually view your memories in the Minority Report sense, someone's testimony is totally admissible. And yet they've done different studies to see, like, you know, you remembered him as a 5-foot-tall guy. I remembered him as a 3-foot-tall guy.
Right.
Oh, she remembered him as being 7 feet tall. You know, whatever.
So, and that's the noise factor too. The malleability of memory is noise. When you're trying to transmit the signal of what you remember, the fact that you're not going to remember it accurately is the noise element. And so, what do we do to, as a culture, to mitigate that? We invent writing so that we can have more accurate recollection, right? And then we invent photography and we invent film. We invent all these ways of recording our environment and our own experience of reality. And then that becomes like solid, like irrefutable. I mean, the written word as the word of God, we're back to that. I mean, it's, you know, the act of uttering something that is derived from your own mind is, you know, to me it all ties back to that, like getting it out, extracting the memory in some form and encapsulating it in some object preserves it, you know. And this whole idea of preserving of memories, preserving of people, preserving of all of this, I know I'm starting to riff here and kind of do a little bit of a word association, but I'm doing that to stress how I find all of these things inherently related, and tying back to all of the stuff with language and with letters and glyphs, to me and the mother talking to its baby. I mean, to me, if there is an origin of, or if there is an explanation of sync and symbolic power and all of these things that we're exploring here, it all comes down to like breaking down the fundamental kind of elements, if you will, the periodic table of communication and language, because that is the denoising technology that humanity invented to address this, the maybe scenario, really. The fact that we have this huge dilemma that we all see things slightly differently. So we desperately need something to solve that noise problem, right? And every step, every new version of language that we invent always has a new version of noise that we have to address. and it manifests in now countless ways, millions, billions probably ways in terms of ways in which we've communicated. And it's those things. It's the fact, it's the origin of the ampersand or the record scratch sound and its context. All of those little things, those are the to me, the areas ripe for investigation as to kind of some of the causes and maybe some of the sources of our tendency to, when we encounter a certain alignment of these elements, something in our brain just connects and we experience this sensation that we call synchronicity or whatever. And I think, I don't have necessarily any or claim to be able to define what it is to anyone, but I feel like personally for me that's been like the area in which, you know, I don't know, the most discovery can be made in terms of why this happens, you know, if that's what we're trying to answer. And I'm not sure that everyone is, but it seems that way.
Yeah, I obviously this is something I'm trying to do. I'm trying to play with some of the same things here.
Yeah, obviously.
And you know, and answer some of the same. These are big questions.
Big questions.
Pretty darn big. Yeah.
But so, I mean, am I making sense? Because this is the kind of thing I, you know, the dangerous part of exploring this area is it becomes so broad. It can become so broad when you're dealing with such fundamental things that, you know, you can literally turn anything into this long, seemingly endless, you know, examination, because it can be applied to literally anything. And it's driven me to the point of, you know, very close to even like significant psychotic breaks, like, because it's just like, if you really think about it, as often as the world gives you opportunities to, you'll never stop.
Yeah. Well, I definitely don't want you to have a psychotic
break. Oh no, I'm not suggesting I'm going to. I've gotten good at preventing that. It did happen to me once.
What's that?
It did happen to me once. About 13 years ago.
Oh, how did that go?
At the time, it was not fun. Well, it was really fun for a while, and then it got really unfun. When family intervened. And then, but, you know, I worked out. I tucked it away for a long time. I felt like when it did happen, I was very... There was a lot about the experience I had that I felt was real and significant. And then, but I think that I was just, you know, it's like that line in The Matrix, you know, sometimes the mind doesn't accept like the truth or whatever. And I think I had figured a lot of things out back then that I still hold true today, but was not prepared. And so it took me, it caused me to do some really stupid shit. Nothing violent or harmful, just weird.
Totally.
But I came out of it, and it's actually, it's really funny because I realized right when I quit Facebook that I joined my very first social media website in 2003, which was Friendster. Remember Friendster?
I have heard of it, but I've never been on it.
Okay, so I was on Friendster back then, and I realized, my God, that was not long after I kind of finally, you know, recovered from my meltdown that had happened about less than a year before that. And I was like, gosh, you know, this whole time from 2003 up until August of 2014, I've been on social media. And, like, that was something that took up more and more of my time almost every day over the last 11 years or whatever that was. And it was when I left Facebook and I actually reopened a lot of these old kind of areas of interest that I was really interested in the time I had that breakdown. And that's actually what led me to Sync Radio and all of this stuff. And just kind of, but this time around, I was able to deal, you know, I was like much more just grounded, you know, and have been able to.
Well, I'm glad to hear that, because I think, you know, a lot of people who come to this are not grounded. And I sometimes, you know, I think we all, honestly, I think we go through phases.
Absolutely.
They're perfectly healthy phases, that even there's going to be days that, man, this stuff's going to fucking weigh on you and it's going to be too goddamn much.
Oh, and it came close back then. Like, right when I quit Facebook for about a month there, I was closer than I have been since to feeling like I was going to lose it. I really was, but I kept it in check.
But I almost feel like if you can keep it in check, these moments of, you know, these moments of fluctuation are almost part of the natural flow of it.
I agree, and I thought it was, you know, I realized the last time it happened that it was actually a healthy thing, you know, and I think that it's important. I mean, the thing is like, you mentioned this at some point before, too, the idea of kind of having your feet on the ground and your head in the clouds at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And I think that that's, to me, that represents kind of the ideal, you know, of like, I don't know if you've ever listened to any, like, Alan Watts.
Sure.
One of the great things that I've heard him talk about is, you know, a lot of his students would approach him asking, like, if meditation is necessary or if yoga is necessary and all these things. And he says, not necessarily, you know, in his typical way. And talks about the idea of living via active meditation. And to me, a great analogy of that is this concept of having your head in the clouds and your feet on the ground at the same time at all times, and just trying to go throughout your life in a kind of, you know, present and mindful at all times, not necessarily considering that something you have to do as an isolated activity and then return to this state where it wouldn't necessarily be appropriate for you to be, quote-unquote, meditating, right? And it was actually, you know, some of the times where I felt I was closest to a break, where I actually ended up realizing were the times I was achieving that state more than I ever had.
Yes. 'Cause,
you know, where you are actively just really mindful, and just this idea of the state you are trying to achieve when you meditate is actually the state you want to constantly be in as you go throughout your life. And it's remarkable, like, if you try to do that sometimes, like, as long as you, you know how to control that, because it can be, you become very delicate and fragile mentally, I think, too, but which is it's a very powerful state, and it's a very vulnerable state at the same time. Anyway. I'm not exactly sure how we got into that, but it's fun.
No. I'm very much. You know, it's just a question for me of. All right. Let me just say it. So here's a question I come up with. I ask myself pretty often.
Okay.
You know, what is, do we have a moral obligation to, it's like a truth in advertising, in the sense of, hey, I'm gonna talk to you about some crazy shit. You know, this could cause you to get interested in this crazy shit, could cause you some sleepless nights. You know, you know, you don't start peeling the layers off reality without a few bumps in the road.
Sure.
To put it mildly.
Yeah.
And that's something that I kind of.
So like you asked yourself whether or not it's a good idea to bring that to someone else, or what exactly?
You know, yeah. Well, or just to, you know, do we, okay, so like you're going to be hosting a podcast that you're going to be exploring these things, plus, you know, fully aware of, as I said before, do you say something, do you say something as clearly as possible to transmit the information, or do you say something fully aware of a certain amount of noise in the signal to, you know, make them think? Well, now if I've.
Okay. Now that's a big question.
Yeah, like
it's a huge question.
If there's someone out there who's listening and they're, you know, kind of unsure where their head is at, you know, and they're struggling with this.
Yeah.
And then I'm kind of like, you know what? I'm going to take it upon myself to, you know, give them the challenge that I think they need at this point. You know, I have a friend, Bill, who used to, he was one of the original hosts to always record for the first few years. And he does this on Facebook regularly. And he kind of like, almost like picks like arguments with people. And sometimes he's just doing it to see, it's almost like get a reaction,
yeah,
to like his to hope that they'll find their blind spot.
Right.
He's poking and prodding.
Yeah, it's a provocateur almost.
Yeah, but like not like in a sinister.
No,
way,
I understand.
In a, like,
I totally understand, and I think that that's.
But again, I guess, so here's my question: with good intentioned. That's the best intentions possible. Couldn't that still, you could still, who the fuck are you to decide to poke and prod somebody that you don't know how they're going to handle it? Do you know what I mean?
Yes.
So I don't like there, I don't know how I feel about, like, again, this is a, you know, areas of morality, which if everything is questionable.
Well, I think though, let me break it down a little bit more though, then. What if you differentiated that question depending on who is coming to who for is somebody, because it's one thing, I think, for an individual to come out and just spout, you know, unsolicited provocations or, you know, any, or, you know, some kind of piece of information intended to provoke or to get a reaction. It's another thing for an individual seeking something, anything, whether it's the ultimate answer or it's just to be entertained. But if
right.
Then if somebody comes to you and says, "Hey, entertain me," and then you ask that same question, okay, now I'm being asked to speak, if so to speak. So do I say something that will merely entertain them as they have asked, or since you know, oh shit, sorry, one second, I'm getting wife texts, but you see where I'm getting at? It's like,
absolutely, you know? And again, I'm fully aware of that question in the sense of like, if I'm an entertainer or just an artist. I don't want to self-censor myself. Like, I want to say whatever it is I feel inclined to say, whether I mean it seriously, sarcastically, or whatever. I'm just, like I said, I occasionally stop and go, you know what? Do I have, is there a moral responsibility at any point to stop and consider, you know, the mental, the helping or hindering the mental state of the person receiving it?
Right. Well, I think that's, you know, I mean, speaking, you know,
I think I've been doing a fairly okay job of balancing those two.
I think you have, absolutely.
I try and, if I'm doing something where I'm talking such as this, I try and be very straightforward and say, this is what I mean, and I hope people take care of themselves, and whatever. Right. If I'm doing something artistic, I'm just going to be like, all right, you know,
right.
Here's some shit. Good luck figuring
that one out.
Well, it's
funny because I'm at a point, this is so relevant and timely for me personally, at least, because it's, I feel, I mean, I am drawn to this format after over a decade of trying to communicate these ideas subtly through art and feel like I succeeded artistically, I feel like. I recorded and performed some music I'm proud of that people enjoyed, but beyond that, I did not. I don't think at all. And that was definitely a huge part of my motivation, is to do that in addition to doing music I enjoy, you know. I wanted to incorporate all of that stuff, and I made it the way I would have loved to have discovered it, you know. I embedded, you know, I created all this mythology and created just endless detail that somebody could just obsess over. You know, and because for me personally, it was that the act of doing that and interpreting other people's art and other people's ideas, and the process of discovery and just the sensation of like of discovery and feeling like you've unlocked something or you know, I mean, that to me was the real power in teaching me things and just learning more and then wanting to continue to do that, you know. But I feel like, which is why I was such a strong believer in kind of embedding a lot of this stuff on deeper levels in art, because I felt that me unraveling things like that in other art was why I became so into it in the first place, and that sense of discovery. But over time, I also realized how unusual that actually is. You know, no one really, most people don't, you know, explore something that deep. Most people don't watch the same movie 40 times and then figure out some amazing new pattern, you know, that may or may not even exist, you know. I was a strong supporter, though, and still am, but do feel defeated by the amount of effort I put into something I feel that will reach very few people, if anyone, you know, in terms of the deeper meaning I was trying to convey. Who knows?
I mean, it's why, say, like someone like a Stanley Kubrick, right?
Yeah.
Like, so people will obsess over his fucking movies. At this point, they could be finding shit he's embedded in there, or they could be finding his mistakes. It doesn't matter. It's become a life of its own. But
it's reached a cultural status where people, I mean, it's considered this masterpiece or he's considered this, you know, master filmmaker, and it's very rare. I feel like we'll never again put artists that are working now, very small amount, it'll be so difficult to ever reach that kind of status again, you know, just because of the nature of how.
Maybe in a different medium.
Maybe, but I think, you know, because of the fact that there's a lot of the mystique of making a film is gone.
That's what I'm saying. It has to be a new medium, right?
You're right. You're right. No, you know, okay, I see your point.
So
totally.
We're never going to have another great composer. You know, like, all our great composers are in the past.
There hasn't been one in over 100 years.
That's what I'm saying. Which, of course, there have been.
Of course. But culture, like big cultural icons.
Right. Culturally, that's, the mystique is gone.
Yep.
Right? It's like literacy. Okay. You know, as you said, there was a time where a very small percentage of the population could even read or write.
Totally.
Now, everyone can read or write. You wrote a book. Good for you. Right? Okay. Oh,
right. And this is
exactly...
This is exactly tying back to what we were talking about earlier, and the fact that, you know, the mystique of writing and the magical act of recording a thought is now so far removed from our experience. Now the fact that I'm doing Star Trek with you right now. I'm talking to you over video.
Completely. Yeah.
And it's like no big deal. That's such an accumulation of all of these things that were at once filled with wonder and mystique, that was totally sucked out of them because the next thing came along, and the next thing, and the next thing, and here we are, right? And like you said, there's not going to be this... Well, you know who I think of, actually, all of a sudden? About to your point about the next medium, Elon Musk, that dude. He's this technological modern Da Vinci whack, you know, kind of god, in a way, and he's not even an artist. Or people like Steve Jobs is not really an artist,
right.
but look at the pedestal that that guy's on. Some of it richly deserved, not all of it.
Right. They are the Henry Fords of our era.
Right.
Right?
I mean,
you can get cultural status through, you know, advancing this technology. Henry Ford was... Fuck, you read Brave New World. He wrote that the religion was based around Henry Ford, right? So now we would say, Steve Jobs will be the prophet of the future. You know, and someone could make that comment, and it would be believable. Like, I could totally see that.
I have seen it.
Right.
Prophetic is often... I've certainly heard him described as prophetic in terms of, you know, well, his predictions about things, or his business savvy, you know. When he pitched a phone with no buttons, everyone thought he was crazy, but now we know that was prophetic, or whatever. So, yeah, I mean, the thing is to me, when I, I'm a huge fan of technology, and I depend on it these days, just like most people, but at the same time, I've become very wary of this relentless push for innovation, or what we call innovation, and because... When you stop for a second and really kind of step back and think about what are the value systems that drive innovation, or what is it that somebody invents and we consider innovative? It's something that basically makes our life more convenient. I mean, at the end of the day, almost all technological innovation aimed at consumers today is about convenience. And what is convenience? Making all of the realities of your life in terms of the responsibilities you have as a human, making them easier to deal with, or making them easier to avoid, even. And that seems a little fucked up. And it's like, what is this push towards convenience, which is fundamentally a desire to have more leisure time? To do what? You know.
So what you said before. Okay, more leisure time meant more ability to explore these.
Right.
But as you say, is it just further distraction?
Right. Well, I think that today escapism now is what people want to fill their leisure time with. Most people. You know.
And the temptation's definitely there. Isn't that part of the Facebook? Time suck is
right.
I could be doing this other thing, but yeah, or I could just scroll through this thing for the next hour.
Right. I don't know. I mean, it's hard for me to apply any value judgment because I'm so integrated into that system that, you know, I
I couldn't sleep at night if I, you know, but, and that's a real question I'm always asking myself, because I mean, I acknowledge daily that there is a lot about what I kind of have principled views of that I can't escape at the same time without severely adjusting my way of life or in my lifestyle, which is comfortable and I like. So it's very conflicting, I guess.
For sure. I mean, the only thing I could say is, you know, I'm not gonna, I can be conflicted, but I also know that I'm not going to, if all I really have to go on at the end of the day is my instincts and my ideas, and if there's an idea, like, I know I feel compelled, and maybe, look, I know I feel compelled to scroll through Facebook, so maybe that's a compulsion.
Right.
But that feels like I can tell the difference between an unhealthy compulsion like that versus a healthy compulsion to make a piece of artwork that makes me smile and that's thought-provoking.
Right.
So even if it becomes someone's time distraction, it's going to be someone else's motivator or inspiration.
Oh, yeah. No, and that's the thing. That's why I love that. And I do feel that a lot of this tradition that speaks to the way in which all forms of art and media throughout history has been this in terms of like even the type of analysis that is being done, like symbolic analysis of lots of pop culture and films, et cetera, et cetera. But if you take that, you know, that's already been done to so much of literature and art, et cetera, throughout history. But with certain lenses, when you approach all of that stuff, I think that we're all finding this thread of how all of this stuff has, through a certain group of people all over the planet and in different cultures at different times, have injected this awareness of this underpinning kind of collective conscious existence. And that's why, to this very day, more and more people every day are tuning into this idea that there is this, you know, we're experiencing synchronicity, and the more you look into it, the more you unravel that there's all of these connected ideas to synchronicity and et cetera, and it leads you down to mystery schools and esoteric ideas, et cetera, et cetera. And to me, it's just this thread throughout history of this awareness of how we're all connected by the noise in the signal. And it's within. I mean, every time human beings are forced to adapt to noise, we leave this stamp of our collective consciousness on that somehow. And I guess after all is said and done, after everything we've talked about today, to me that's kind of, you know, what connects it all together is there very much is this shared consciousness that is very real, and we are very, very disconnected from it in certain aspects today. But the remnants of its presence in our lives that was more significant in the past are sprinkled all over the place in culture and in these ways in which these symbols constantly shift in meaning and constantly shift in context and all of that stuff. And it's not the symbols themselves, but it's the causes of those shifts, the causes of those recontextualizations or whatever, however you want to call it, that to me are at the core of why these occur and what their real meanings are, I guess. If That was an attempt to kind of sum all of this up. I don't know if I succeeded.
It was a brave attempt. I think it was good.
My brain hurts a little bit.
Yeah, for real.
That was tasty.
Thank you for listening to this broadcast from the SyncBook Radio. If you enjoyed this episode, there's so much more content waiting for you at thesyncbook.com. Tune in to our other SyncBook Radio programs, 42 Minutes, Always Record, the Marty Leeds Math Magical Radio Hour, Synchronize, Pentimental, and Sync Quick News. Our newest episodes are always free, and members get access to our full archive of over 600 hours. You'll find all of this, as well as our books and videos, at thesyncbook.com.
All I ever smoke is tobacco in suburbia. All I ever smoke is tobacco in suburbia. Everybody brags about the way they done somebody out of money they have cleverly invested. Everyone is making friends with other people just like them, and anyone who's different is detested. I come home and I lay me down. I get a call to come downtown. And so my brother's bail, he's been arrested for smiling. And all they ever smoke is tobacco in suburbia. Tobacco.